Another fine show brought to you by the Law of Attraction Radio Network. The Law of Attraction Talk Radio is the radio show that is changing the world through science and spirituality as we realize that our well-being and our happiness is through our own thoughts. The Law of Attraction Talk Radio, the Jules. Well, welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful Southern California, and right now I am cruising in Baja California on the Cruise to Transformation. I'm going to tell you all about the exciting stuff with it next week, but tonight I have pre-recorded this segment with none other than Dr. Bruce Lipton, who happens to be my all-time favorite scientist and teacher. Bruce is talking about his new and really incredible book, Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future, and How to Get There from Here. Does this cellular biologist and former medical school professor believe in 2012? Well, you might be surprised to find out some really incredible things that you may not have heard him say before. Bruce lays out the future of the world as well as the economy and the way we may be living in the future. This is a great interview and so insightful, so stay with us. Come discover Canada's most unique and inspirational events, the Body, Soul, and Spirit Expo. Explore the many ways to improve your life mentally, physically, and spiritually as you expand your own consciousness. Attend seminars and workshops with the world's most life-changing authors, experts, and speakers. Body, Soul, Spirit Expo events are throughout Canada to fit your schedule, and with inspirational speakers such as shamanic best-selling author Dr. Stephen Farmer and superfood guru David Wolf. To find a Body, Soul, Spirit Expo that you would like to attend, go to www.bodysoulspiritexpo.com. That's Body, Soul, Spirit Expo.com. Access your forgotten abilities to create a happy and joyful life that is filled with abundance through the Law of Attraction Radio Network. Listen to shows that will inspire and uplift your consciousness, required to fulfill your desires, by downloading your favorite shows to your MP3 player. Join us at loaradionetwork.com. That's loaradionetwork.com. Next week, we're going to be talking to Linda Hotchkiss about the Board of Knowledge. You know, we're going through a most significant spiritual evolution that has ever taken place in the history of mankind, and we all can rise to levels that have never been available before. The Board of Knowledge is a way to open up things and make it different in an individual's life. Linda will explain exactly how the Board of Knowledge may be right for you, so tune in for that next week. And then after that, we're going to be speaking to Amy Bush, who is a spiritual healer who chose to ignore her awareness of her intuition. Amy began her journey through deliberate thought work to align her mind with her soul, as that proved to be quite the task. Even though it yielded promising results, she was faced with death not once, but twice. This is a wonderful story of the inner discovery of a healer. Then, after that, the last Sunday of the month of November, we are going to have Stuart St. John on the show. You're not going to want to miss this. Stuart has composed music with Esther Hicks and her Sarah books. You will discover, as Esther Hicks did, that the entities that make up Abraham come through Stuart, but in a musical form. Stuart sent me this incredible soul music that we used on the cruise to create a powerful energy vortex. And let me tell you, it takes you immediately in there. What's so surprising is that Stewart cannot read or write music, and Esther Hicks has verified that this is Abraham in full force writing and composing this music. Wait till you hear it. Get ready to shift your consciousness with this incredible segment of Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I am so thrilled to be talking and introducing you to Stewart St. John. And stay with us in December as well as we talk to Neil Donald Walsh, and Dr. Shah will be returning. We're also going to be introducing the newest healer phenomenon, Amin Hamid, who will be doing distant healing emissions right from the broadcast. So stay tuned for that. You're going to love it. And don't forget, every month we're going to have international astrologer Marguerite Manning for the Therapy of the Soul series on the first Sunday of every month. You know, if you want to be updated on these terrific shows coming up, go to loaradionetwork.com to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio Show and put down your email address in the update form. That way I can send you everything that's going on every single week. You won't miss something really spectacular. You know, we are going to close out the year with the realization that the choice to remain stuck in old thought patterns is a choice and not a necessity. On Law of Attraction Talk Radio, as well as Law of Attraction Radio Network, we give you so many different ways that can help you become the magnificent creator that you are. There is no one-size-fits-all formula. Everyone has their own way of remembering. We simply provide you with the information that you can accept or not. But here's my wish for you for the end of the year: that you understand you have a choice to be happy or sad. You have the choice to lose the resistance or remain stuck. You have the choice to be in love with life or to accept life on default reactionary mode. It's all up to you. There is no right way or wrong way. It's all your choice. And that's what I want you to get out of Law of Attraction Talk Radio for the end of the year. Now let's talk to Dr. Bruce Lipton. Bruce Lipton, PhD, is an internationally recognized leader in bridging science and spirit. He has been a guest speaker on hundreds of TV and radio shows, as well as a keynote presenter for national and international conferences. Dr. Bruce Lipton began his scientific career as a cellular biologist. In 1982, Dr. Lipton began examining the principles of quantum physics and how they may be integrated into his understanding of the cell's information processing system. He produced breakthrough studies on cell membrane, which revealed that this outer layer of cell is simply a computer chip, the cell's equivalent of a brain. His research at Stanford University School of Medicine between 1987 and 1992 revealed that the environment operating through the membrane controlled the behavior and physiology of the cell, turning genes on and off. His discoveries, which ran counter to the established scientific view that life is controlled by the genes, is one of today's most important fields of study, the science of epigenetics. Two major scientific publications derived their studies to find the molecular pathways connecting the mind and body. Many subsequent papers by other researchers have validated his concepts and ideas. Dr. Lipton's novel scientific approach transformed his personal life as well. His deepened understanding of cell biology highlighted the way by which the mind controls bodily functions and implied the existence of an immortal spirit, such as reincarnation. He applied his science to his personal biology and discovered that his physical well-being improved, and the quality and character of his daily life was greatly enhanced. You may also remember that Bruce was the featured speaker in my all-time favorite movie, The Living Matrix. I tell you all this because he's just not an ordinary scientist. He's a scientist that has shifted the consciousness of mankind, and that's why his latest book, Spontaneous Evolution, is so very important to read. Welcome back, Bruce, to Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
I am so delighted to be here, and especially during these very exciting times.
First, let me just start off by saying how incredible your new book, Spontaneous Evolution, is. It is perfect for this time that we're going through. Just what the doctor ordered.
Well, it's such an exciting time. And, you know, I guess that there's an old saying about living in interesting times. And, boy, are we in the middle of that right now. We're in one of the greatest epics in human evolution at this very moment. And while people are looking outside, and I'm very much sure that they're looking at it with, oh my God, the sky is falling, the fact is, what a great thing. And if you understand why it's falling, then it's a great thing. If you don't, of course, it'll be a very scary situation. So it's exciting because the world is in a state of evolution. Very simple statement. Science has already recognized we're facing our own imminent extinction because of the disruption of the biosphere that we have participated in. And then I invoke an old Einstein quote that is so fabulous, and the quote is, you can't solve the problems with the same thinking that created them. And why that's relevant is that the thinking that created them is now is actually the foundation of the institutions of our civilization, like healthcare and politics and economy and academia. All these institutions have been supporting a belief system that if we continue to follow that, then science has already painted the sign that says end of the line, coming right up.
Oh, end of the line. So how does this relate to spontaneous evolution? What does that mean exactly?
Well, we have always had a belief, and academia taught students a belief that evolution is a very slow, imperceptible process that occurs over millions and millions of years where gradual changes occur and you don't see really big differences. That vision of evolution is actually found not to be an accurate assessment, that we go back now and there's something new called punctuated equilibrium. And what that means is this, what they found is that life starts and forms and has a nice, beautiful, just growing very peacefully and everything's great, and then all of a sudden an upheaval occurs and it causes a mass extinction. And then within a very short time after the mass extinction of life, the remnants of life that are left over generate all new kinds of species. And then that goes for a period of time, and it seems very stable and grows very nicely. And then all of a sudden another punctuation, and that all that life essentially gets wiped out except for a few of the crumbs. And those leftovers actually then generate, again, a whole new set of organisms for the environment. Well, nature has done this five times. Scientists call these mass extinctions, and that five different times in the history, life has been wiped out by some punctuation mark that causes an abrupt change, and then all new life begins after that. So the belief that evolution is a slow, continuous process is actually not true. Evolution goes along in a steady state, has a punctuation, and then evolution takes a big jump and goes to some other level, and then at some point another punctuation mark of some kind, and then takes a big jump. Well, science has recognized that the five previous mass extinctions have been due to extraterrestrial forces such as comets, asteroids, hitting the Earth and turning the environment upside down, and that was what led to the extinction. Today, science has recognized that we are deep into the sixth mass extinction. And the significance about that is that that means that evolution is coming to this punctuation mark. And what's unique about this one, science has recognized, is that it's due to actually human behavior. And so it says that the way we've been living our lives on this planet has been so destructive to the planet that is provoking this punctuation mark in our evolution. And so the nature of the fact is that the evolution that is before us is not a slow, gradual unfolding. It's going to be just like lightning. Something struck, and all of a sudden there's this great upheaval. So it's an abrupt change. And the book that I talk about, Spontaneous Evolution, means that we're going to hit this like switch, and it'll be just amazing. And the people here, which will be almost everybody here on this line, because it's going to happen very soon, will be in this most amazing evolution where we switch from an old way of life to a new way of life. And the title is also related to a concept called spontaneous remission. And spontaneous remission means that we talk about a patient that is like terminally ill. Everybody counts the patient out, getting ready for that person's death. And all of a sudden, there's a profound transformation, and the patient has this instantaneous recovery. And these spontaneous remissions are all due to one thing, and that is when the patient has a profound change of belief, all of a sudden their body heals instantaneously, and they're no longer a terminal patient, spontaneous remission. So the evolution that we're coming to has two aspects about it. One is that it's going to happen very abruptly and very quickly, but the recovery of where we are right now can happen in the same way that a patient recovers, because the civilization, the biosphere, is a living organism, and we are looking at, oh my God, we're counting ourselves out. And the reality is, yeah, but to make a change in our beliefs, a change in the way we live, is the same kind of change that provides that patient with an opportunity to go from a terminal case and all of a sudden be spontaneously healed. So right immediately in front of us is an abrupt punctuation mark, and if we collectively understand how to live in harmony with this planet, and we change our belief systems as a civilization, it will essentially restore the health of the planet back to absolute beauty.
Bruce, that kind of sounds like the Mayan calendar in the year 2012. Is that what you're referring to?
Isn't that a coincidence? And it's not a coincidence. And what people have to recognize about 2012 is there's this vision, it's the end of the world. It's like, no, it's not the end of the world. It specifically says it's the end of the way we are living in the world, meaning we change a way of life at this point, and the old way of life will transition into a new way of life, and it's very much it's all connected to the actions of the planet in regard to space. And you say, well, that's astrology, and I go, well, yes, it's astrology, but it's a little more than that, because there's a scientific level of how the electromagnetic fields and the information in space, the so-called the field, changes in regard to where the planet is in its relationship to the solar system. And as we move through these changes, this is what the old civilizations recognize, that we go through epochs, and astrologers refer to them as, you know, each of the 12 constellations. I can't remember the name, just dropped out, the 12, like the horoscope constellations. And the significance about that is that there's indeed a pattern of how we move through the world. Just like the clock hand sweeps around the face of the clock and the numbers change, the Earth is like the end of one of those clock hands, and it moves through around the solar system. It changes in response to what's going on in the solar system. So the 2012 event is an important point in an astrological significance, because it has this massive lineup that only occurs like every, I don't know how many thousands of years, 50,000 years or 52, I can't remember exactly, but the 2012 story says it's a cyclic pattern. We're coming back to an alignment that has happened before, and that going from one alignment to the next alignment, we go through the signs of the zodiac. And these signs of the zodiac actually flavor, because of the field, life on the planet. So astrology to conventional scientists, it's like, oh, metaphysics stuff. And yet, when you understand the nature of quantum mechanics and how life responds to the invisible energy field, then all of a sudden it becomes more like an astrophysiology. So 2012 means there's a big astrological significance because it changes the energy field around the Earth, and that is coinciding with the ending of the way we are living and the precipitation of a new way of life. And so we're right on schedule. Everything's going just right. And I say that, and I'm sure there's a lot of people wincing. What do you mean?
Oh, yeah. It's the fear of the unknown. So I'm hearing you say that 2012 is, in fact, going to happen as per the Mayan calendar, and it's the end of the way of our current thinking and our current reality, but it's not the end of the world. It's not total end times where we're all going to perish. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Absolutely, and they're changing. Here's what from a distance, what is the evolution? And the evolution is this. It's not the evolution of the individual human. A human being evolved a million or more years ago, and that's the evolution. That's just what it is. The next level of evolution isn't the enhancement or change of the individual human. What it represents is when humans realize they're all part of one giant super organism called humanity. That when I talk about in the biology belief, I talk about you look at your body and you see it as a single entity, and then I say, you know, that's a misperception, because your body is not a single entity. It's the living structures are cells. You're made out of about 50 trillion cells. You're not a one thing. You're a giant super community of individual cells, and each cell is essentially biologically the equivalent of a miniature human. And so you say, well, what does that mean? Well, that before humans evolved, there were cells out there like living by themselves, and through the process of evolution, they learned to come together, form community, and that community's ultimately evolved to the advanced community called a human being. Well, the human being then turns out to be an individual community, but then when you put all the humans together as individuals, then all the humans together come together and create a superorganism, and we are the cells in the body called humanity. And they say, well, what's the difference? And the answer is, today we live as individuals, and my life is different than your life, and whatever I do is like, well, that's separate and distinct from whatever you do. Tomorrow's evolution says, we're all in this together. And every human's action affects every other human's action, just as much as every cell in your body affects every other cell.
Oh, that's an aha moment for me right there.
So what does it mean? It says, we learn to come in harmony, the whole globe. And in this harmony, we learn to communicate with each other. We change the way of living, that because the way of living is the destruction itself. You know, people say, well, geez, 2012 is, I'm fear of the unknown. And I'm thinking, when you said that, I said, you know what? I'd have fear of the known, because the known is you're going extinct. And so I would have more fear of that at this moment, because that's a scientific reality. And so how do you not go extinct? The answer is, we must change. And so I'm not going out there saying, look, start the change now. The change has been happening already, and we're in it.
So, in fact, we are actually then becoming cells that are responsible for this great big universe in order to survive. It's not an individual, but we are now becoming smaller and thinking more globally.
Absolutely. I mean, look at it this way. If I could reduce you to the size of a cell inside your body, and you looked at all the other cells, and I said, you know, in reality, they're functionally equivalent to miniature humans, but just for a moment, pretend that these cells have little human shapes, and I could shrink you down to the size of a human in that body, it wouldn't be too much of a different relationship to each other as cells as we now relate to each other as people. It's, you know, and so basically, we have to recognize, well, why is it so important to come together in this community? And the answer is because awareness is knowledge, and knowledge is power, and awareness of the world and the universe allows us to exercise some control over our lives. And what we're beginning to realize in this new awareness is that we are all part of this one organism, and when we start to create the community and harmony, I say, well, what's the benefit of that? And then I would just have to say, well, look, when you take a blissed out human being you see one individual, and what I'm saying, no, you're looking at 50 trillion cellular citizens all blissed out at once.
Wow.
Yeah, and in the body called humanity, when it understands the nature of its life and becomes blissed out as a superorganism, that means every cell in that community, which numbers about 7 billion right now, would also be blissed out as part of the same living organism. And so we either are killing each other now. In fact, there's a biological correlation to the state of civilization now to the state of human health, and that is right now we're killing each other. Cells are killing each other, competing and trying to beat each other in a struggle for survival. And it turns out that if you go inside the body, any body in which the cells start fighting with each other, that body, in medical terms, is expressing what we call autoimmune disease. Autoimmune disease is self-destructive disease. You say, well, what are autoimmune diseases? Well, things like arthritis or cancer, cardiovascular disease in many cases. Most of the diseases we have are self-destruction. And it's like, yeah, isn't that interesting? The experience on the outer world and the experience on the inner world are manifesting the same experiences. And so the state of our own health is a reflection of what's going on in the environment. We come together in a community and recognize the harmony of the community, then all our cells in our own body will also accommodate that pattern. And each one of us becomes healthy and the whole thing becomes healthy.
Okay, then let's put everything in terms that we can relate to today. Let's talk about Western society, the U.S. Right now, we're so polarized. We're fighting each other. We are becoming the cancer that seek to destroy each other.
Absolutely, if we don't change.
Then let's talk about the four myths that you describe in your book. I think these are very important to understand.
These are myths that we hold today as scientific truths. Okay? And basically it says is this: we shape our world based on what we believe about how the world operates. So we adjust our culture to fit our truths about the world. And I say, okay, well, what truths are we entertaining in our culture? What truths is our culture following in regard to what we believe about the world? And the truths come from today. They come from science. In the last phase of civilization, the truths came from the church. So, if you lived in the 1500s, you had a question about the world or your life or what's going on in your, anywhere, you would go to your truth provider, which was your priest. The church provided truth. About 1860, after Darwin's theory of evolution, science became civilization's truth provider. So today, if you want to know something about the world, you go to a scientist, you don't go to the church. So, we say, okay, well, what does science tell us about the world? Well, here's the issue. When science tells us the truth about the world, then we adjust our biology and our culture and our lives to conform to those truths so we live in harmony with what we assume to be the truth. So I said, well, what are the four truths that science holds that we now recognize are false? And I say, well, why is that relevant? Because when we held them as a truth, we created a life to match whatever that truth was. But when those truths change, then civilization has to readjust its course, adjust its culture, its behavior, to accommodate how to live with a new truth to sustain ourselves. So the relevance of the book is the truths have changed by the way we, our scientific truths that gauge the way we live on this planet have changed, especially in the last 20 years. And then you say, yeah, but why is there nothing coming out from this new truth? And the point is, the new truths are from the leading edge of science. And you say, well, what is the leading edge science information? Does it come to the public? And it says, no, it takes a while to get that kind of stuff into the media. And then we're also finding that there's resistance to bringing the new truth to the public. And you say, well, why should anybody resist the truth of science? And the answer is because some of the institutions and organizations that exist today will be compromised by the new truth because some of these new truths pull the foundation out of these organizations. I'll give you one of them. The pharmaceutical industry is living on an old scientific belief that is now found to be incorrect, and it will essentially lead to the demise of that industry. And I'll have to say, well, an industry as big as the pharmaceutical industry is not interested in us getting those new truths because it will undermine their whole corporate structure. So the media has been very difficult to get the new science out. But the new science is profound. So now that I said all that preamble stuff, what are the four truths that change and how does that affect us? So I'll say, number one, the conventional truth of biomedical science, which is the science that deals with our lives, is that we live in a Newtonian world. And you say, what does that mean? And I say, in a Newtonian perception of physics, the universe is made out of physical parts and particles. It's like a giant clock with gears, and it's a mechanism. And a Newtonian-based science does not entertain the concept of invisible forces influencing the physical structures, which means things like spirit and consciousness and all that. That can't come into today's science, because today's science says, only thing you have to study is the physical world. Take a body apart. It's made out of molecules, which are like gears, and you can adjust them and adjust the way the body works. So that's the mission of the pharmaceutical industry. Make those gears, those chemical gears that you swallow, put in your body, and adjust your biology. So that's the current belief system. The biology is just a machine. The new insights say, no, wait a minute. Quantum physics comes in and says, the world itself is not really physical. It's all different forms of energy, and all energies are connected, so that the invisible energy is directly connected to the energy that we recognize as physical matter. And this, why that's relevant is it says that the invisible energy, the field, and that's what quantum physics referred to it, the field that surrounds us, like fish are in water and surrounds them. We're, and everything is, in a field of energy. So we're like in a sea of energy called the field. And it turns out, what does quantum physics recognize? The field, the invisible part, is more important in shaping the physical world than the physical world is in shaping itself. That the influences that shape our world are from the invisible stuff. And all of a sudden it says, we haven't even, you know, we've ignored the invisible plane, and it turns out not only have you made a mistake in ignoring it, but the invisible plane itself is influential in shaping the physical world. And I say, well, what's the field? And I say, well, scientifically, the definition of the field are these invisible energy forces that influence the shaping of the physical world. And it's interesting because then I go back and say, what's the definition of spirit? Oh, spirit are these invisible energetic forces that influence the shape of the physical world. And it's like, wow, quantum physics is emphasizing the concept of spirituality, saying the word field, but using essentially the exact same definition that spirit is. So after all these years, we're going to return to a part that we recognize there's a physical world and there's an invisible world, and they're entangled and they work together. And it's something like the Native Americans had 10,000 years ago, when they recognized that every part of nature also had a spiritual component entangled with it. So a deer had a spirit. You wanted to hunt the deer, you have to deal with that invisible part of the deer called the spirit. So they recognized, hey, if you want to do well in the physical world, recognize and honor the invisible world as well. So we come from a belief that, hey, we live in a mechanical, physical world. All I need is material things, and that's why we're so preoccupied in our world with how much material can I get, because if matter is primal, then the more matter you possess, the more fit you are, according to the belief. So the whole world in regard to population is taking the riches out of the ground and accumulating all this material, because it's like a drive force in a world where material is number one. If you have the most material, you win. That's a belief system. Now we go and say, it's not the accumulation of material or anything at all. As a matter of fact, it's the invisible stuff. You say, well, what's the invisible stuff? Love, harmony, joy, peace, the invisible things, the glue that holds us all together and the feelings that we have. We start to recognize you don't need to buy the sports car because you were trying to get a feeling out of buying the sports car. Guess what? You can have the feeling of joy and happiness without the sports car, and that's where we're going. So we start to recognize the joy of being here without having to accumulate all the matter, and that's myth number one. Myth number two, even more quickly because I took so long, myth number two is we are currently living as a population the belief that genes control our lives. We didn't pick our genes as far as we know. We can't change our genes, and apparently genes control who we are. So we are programmed to be victims of our heredity. Then when we become victims of forces such as genes that are outside of our control, then we become irresponsible, because it's like, well, if you can't do anything about it, then you know, why even care? And unfortunately, we've bought the belief that forces outside of our control, our genes, control our traits and our behaviors in our lives, and so that we feel that we've been pre-programmed by our genes. The new biology challenges that, in fact, comes up with an understanding that's so profoundly different it will blow us away, and that is the old belief is called genetic control, which means control by genes. The new science is called epigenetic control. And what's different is epi, the prefix, means above. So when I say epigenetic control, I'm literally saying control above the genes. And we find out, well, what is that thing that controls the genes? It's above the genes and controls the genes. And it turns out our perceptions of life, how an organism perceives the environment, and in humans that perceptions become beliefs, how what a human believes about the environment changes their genetics. And so as you change your beliefs, you change your genes. And why that becomes relevant, then it says, we're not victims of our genes. We're actually masters of our genes. It's just that our genes are creating a world and a life based on our beliefs. And if we change our beliefs, we change our lives. And that is what this whole new agey kind of thing is talking about, is taking back control of your beliefs and your programming. And when you do that, you can rewrite your genetic foundation and change the characteristics in your life. And so that takes us from victim to master. So all of a sudden, people begin to know this. Illness, is, that was a choice. That was a belief system. And you can eliminate illness with your beliefs. And it's funny, I wasn't raised in the Christian tradition, but guess what the new biology is saying? It's saying that your beliefs control these characters in all aspects of our lives. And then I go back to the Bible, and if I paraphrase it, not being trained in that, but I paraphrase it, and Jesus said something like, you could do all the miracles that I can do, even better than I can do them, but you don't believe it. And all of a sudden, it's like, what do you know? Science and the old spiritual stuff, again, is coming back together. And it's not one or the other. It's both. It's not, okay, let's be spiritual and forget science. It's like, no. Science and spirit are uniquely tied together.
Great. So let's make this real clear. Let's talk about cancer and spontaneous remission, and that it all comes down to the belief if you're going to get yourself well or you're going to stay sick. Let's dive into that.
Yes, because, see, it turns out that we were always looking for genes that cause cancer. But they actually don't really have, you know, any genes that cause cancer. They find genes are connected with cancer. In fact, to actually get a cancer off the ground, you have to coordinate the activity of at least 12 to 200 genes. So all of a sudden, it's not you didn't get cancer because a gene flipped and gave you cancer. The new understanding of epigenetics is now revealing that most cancers are actually a response to the individual, the way they are living their life, is causing a disruption of the biology, which is manifesting as a cancer. And when they change the way they live their lives, then they can rewrite that program so the cells don't express the cancer. Now, the difference between a normal cancer patient and that had the spontaneous remission is that these people had such a profound change of belief. They rewrote the programming because this is what we now recognize. We write the genetics on a daily basis and how we respond to life. If we change that, then we can rewrite the genes.
So let's take it another step. I personally have a hard time believing in chemotherapy, and it's really a poison for the body. But if a person absolutely believes that the chemo is going to get them well, then it doesn't matter what kind of treatment they're going to get. It's their belief.
Absolutely it will, because they need that kind of, okay, I need to feel secure that this is the process. So they're giving themselves permission to heal by going through the process. They say, I believe that process is going to heal me, whether the process does or not. That's not the point, because if the individual believes the process heals them, and then they make an active effort to do the process, then in their mind they're saying, I know the process heals me. I just did the process, so I am healed. There used to be in the old days something called Laetril, which was derived from apricot seeds. And a lot of people are getting cured from cancer by it. The FDA said, no, this doesn't really work. push that Laetrile treatment out of the field because I guess medicine didn't come up with it, and then people went overseas and out of the country to get Laetrile treatments, and the significance is they even did better than the people who just got it in the country. But why? Because it was a bigger effort and to fulfill the intention of getting Laetrile, and it turns out scientifically Laetrile is absolutely a placebo. But the reality was these people so firmly believed in it that they would fly out of the country to go get this treatment, and that belief is that major placebo thing. So they healed themselves on the basis of this belief that Laetrile was real and cured themselves of cancer. And a sidebar to that is when later, when some of them heard that the Laetrile was just a placebo effect, some of those people who had been cured up to that point got the cancer back, because the belief system disappeared and the cancer came back. It's like, I couldn't have cured myself. That wasn't real. And boom, they got the cancer again. And the problem about that is when a person has a cancer, what we're really seeing, there's a deep foundation of how you respond to life and your lifestyle that has precipitated this cancer. And then you say, well, I want to heal myself. And then we have, and this is where I want to emphasize, because a lot of people think, oh, it's just positive thinking that I'm going to believe I'll heal and then I'll heal. And I say, well, it's a little more than that, because positive thinking comes from the conscious mind. And there's two minds that run the system, the conscious and the subconscious. And here's the unfortunate part of the story that neuroscience tells us. So the conscious mind, which is our identity, our spirit, our source, our conscious mind has our wishes, our desires, our aspirations, our positive thinking. That's creative thinking, positive thinking. I would like to have that. That's creative. The conscious mind versus subconscious mind, which is habits and belief programs that were programmed in there. It turns out that we only run our lives with our conscious mind less than 5% of the day, and that the subconscious mind is also not only 95% of the day or more in control, but it's also 1,000,000 times more powerful than the conscious mind. I say, well, what's the difference? Conscious mind is what I personally wish, desire, and want in my life. Subconscious mind are programs that we download from our education, our life experiences, and our, especially the first 5 or 6 years of our life. These programs come from other people because they're downloaded. And why is that relevant? Because your conscious mind has your wishes in it, and your subconscious is primarily programmed by beliefs and experiences derived from other people. So if you're operating 95% of the time from the subconscious mind, then you're not really exercising your wishes and your desires. So and positive thinking, remember, comes from that small conscious part, less than 5% of the time. The only time positive thinking really works is if the wish and that positive thought is already supported by a belief in the subconscious program. So if the subconscious agrees with that wish and you have a positive thought, boom, you'll manifest it just like that. But if your subconscious doesn't agree with that, positive thinking is virtually useless at that point. And so it really, we have to recognize, well, why do some people have a cancer, then get treated, and the cancer goes away, and it never comes back? And why do some people get the cancer, get it treated, and then it comes back again? What's the difference between these two people? And the answer is this. The one that doesn't get the cancer back had such a profound life-changing experience from having that cancer that they rewrote something basic about the way they lived their lives, so after the cancer was gone, the way they lived their lives would no longer encourage it. The second group more or less looked at the cancer as, oh, I'm a victim, I got the cancer, the genes did that. Well, let the medical people cut this out, I'll be okay, they'll treat it, and then my machine will be good again. So they didn't have that profound life-changing experience. They just looked at it as, oh, something grew on me, and somebody will take it off of me, and they don't see, you know, any how that influenced or how their life was involved in any way. And those are the people that are most likely then, after having the cancer, taken care of medically, then to have it back again. Why? Because the original programs that precipitated cancer are still in there because the person never changed their life in that regard. Here's a point, just so some curious people, this is like a real nice point. Now, you know, with so much statistics available, they've identified that when children are adopted into a family in which cancer has been running, the adopted child will get the cancer that's in that family with the same propensity as any of the natural siblings, even though they came from completely different genetic stock. And so it really points to the reality. It's being in the family, which is being in the way of how you live life, because we learn this from our parents in that first 5 years. And so the issue is the patterns of cancer are programmable patterns. And if we reprogram the patterns, then we can unprogram the cancer.
So what do you recommend to unprogram the mind?
I actually, on my website, I have a whole thing called resources, because there's so many different ways to do it. And the issue is, you have to, at some point, understand where's the problem coming from. Where's the subconscious belief that is manifesting this, okay? And our old way of, like, how do you find what's in your subconscious, and then we try to do like archaeology and go back in our lives and undig all these things, and oh, your mom did that, and your dad did that, and your friend did this, and these are all the reasons why your life turned out today. And it's interesting, because we can go back, actually undo all that, and everybody says, wow, that's really great, I know why my life is in so much trouble. But guess what they find out? They still have the same life, but now they have knowledge of why they have the trouble, but they still have the same trouble. And the reason is, the conscious mind, subconscious mind, do not learn in the same way. So while the conscious mind can read a self-help book, and I can give you a quiz, and the conscious mind could pass the test, did that change how you live your life, that 95% that comes from the habits in the subconscious mind? The answer is no, because that's not how the subconscious learns. So we're coming into an awareness of an understanding that says, well, how does the subconscious learn? A variety of new approaches and some old approaches, and things like affirmations, but only done on a religious basis. It cannot be you put it on the refrigerator and every time you walk by, you occasionally look at it. The subconscious mind is a habitual mind. Something you do to create habit is how you reprogram it. So that's one way. But I said, well, what are the programs? Do you have to go back? And this is the fun part. You don't have to go back to see what are the programs that are affecting your life, because since your life is 95 and actually to 99% being programmed by your subconscious, there's a simple reality. Your life is a printout of your subconscious beliefs. What does that mean? The things that work in your life and the things that you have and the things that you really like in there, that means you have beliefs that support that. The things you have trouble with, that gives you stress, that you struggle over, those things imply that you have subconscious programs that are in conflict with what you want. And so therefore, it's real easy to say, well, what's your life? Well, then you just review your life and look at it and say, what are the things that work? And say, okay, all those things that work, great. Those programs are great. Just leave those alone. Where am I having problem? I'm not happy about something, or I'm distressed about this, or this thing gives me lots of stress and my concerns, my fears. If once you know what those are just the readouts that say, oh, I need to change these things. So we start changing them, and affirmations are one way. Subliminal tapes, really good. Clinical hypnotherapy, a whole variety of new psychology modalities called energy psychology. Very rapid rewriting. Some of them in minutes rewrite a belief that you had your whole life in minutes, because we're exercising a new understanding of how to put a program into the subconscious mind, compared to our former belief that said, well, if I just become aware of it, then my life will change. And the answer is no. Your conscious mind had become aware of it, but your subconscious mind doesn't learn in that process. So whatever programs were in there before your conscious mind became aware, well, those programs are still in there. So until you change that subconscious, and it's interesting because, well, what are other ways? And it's interesting, not that I encourage this, but those spontaneous remissions that occur, usually they occur because of an emotional shock of life being the way it is. I'll give you an example. A person's on their deathbed. They've just been informed, okay, you've got a month left in your life, and they realize, oh, my God, I'm going to die in a month. And they realize, well, if I got a month, man, I'm going to go out, and I'm going to go and do all those many things in the bucket list. I got to do as many things as I would love to do, which I never did. And I'm going to go out there and screw all those people and my job and all those things that gave me stress. And they say, well, they let go of all the stress. And they say, well, if I only have this much time left, I'm going to go out and enjoy it. And in the process of going out and enjoy it, guess what? They recovered. Because they let go of the irritations that were like putting pins into those cells that irritated them, that initiated the cancer. And that just means, wow, how'd they do it? An emotional shock, like, I'm going to die. Well, when that hits you real, and then you realize you got, hey, so many days left, That's an emotional shock. You make the in this state of emotional shock, you say, I will not do this old way anymore. And the moment they commit to that, the program changes.
Okay, Bruce, I just love this. Let's go really deep into your book right now. What can our cells teach us about solving our current economic crisis, politics, government, universal health care? Oh, my God, our current military budget.
Okay, what I'll talk about is very simply this, is that I mentioned earlier the cells are the functional equivalent of miniature little people. They are. You could shrink yourself down the size of a cell and walk among them. You'd say, hey, it's a community, and they're all hanging out. And guess what? Every cell is an individual entity. It's its own life. It's got its own birth and death. And what's interesting about it, guess what? Every cell has a job. Every cell actually gets paid in a chemical currency called ATP. They're the equivalent of energy coins. And so when the cells are working, they get these energy coins. So every cell has a job. Every cell gets paid. There's an immune system, and the function of the immune system is to, for the 50 trillion cells in the body, is to provide protection and health care. Okay, so every cell is protected. Every cell gets health care. Every cell gets to vote. You say, what do you mean the cells vote in my body? I say, yeah, the emotions that you feel, that's the signals from the cells responding to what's going on as you're, it's like a gauge on the dashboard. An emotion, instead of a needle, is a sense. So as the needle goes from love to fear, and it sweeps from one side to the other side, you get all these different kinds of emotion. Neutral is like, okay, everything's in just perfect balance, and nothing is excitable, and nothing is scary. And as you go toward love, You could, like, if you had the gauge and you could subdivide it, let's say, you say, okay, the gauge is going from neutral, and then it goes to like. That's a feeling. And then it goes to love. That's a great feeling. And the gauge is going deeper into love, and then it goes to cherished or whatever. You know, you can make a whole list of, like, a rainbow spectrum of breaking, you know, from neutral to love up as a gauge. And those are our senses. So I say, your cells are telling you about the operation and what's how the community is responding. When you're in anger, the cells are saying, listen, this is very stressful in here, and now you're stressed. Now you got anger about this. And the issue is we ignore the fact that these senses, these emotions, are the equivalent of gauges on the dashboard of a car, we being the car, the body a vehicle, and we have gauges that tell us about the performance. Well, they're not with needles or LEDs. They're gauges of sensory gauges. So I can feel my body is sending information via the cells releasing chemistry to say what's going on. And it's interesting. In a car, you're driving and you get into stop and go traffic and you're looking at the needle on the temperature gauge and it's you know, running in the normal range, but as you start to go into stop and go, it starts building up the heat and the needle is moving in to the higher temperature and it's going toward that red zone, the scary part where it's going to overheat, and you see this happening and you sit in your car and all common logic, you say, no, well, listen, I'm going to pull over and let this thing cool down and then start up again because otherwise I'm going to damage this. And then I say, anger is a temperature gauge. And you say, what do you mean? I said, well, as it builds up, you get hotter and hotter and hotter. What's the point? If you saw it as a gauge and were detached enough to read it as a gauge, like you saw in your car, you say, oh, I'm getting angry. I better pull over and cool off right here and get my system back, and then I'll go back into the performance again. But we don't see it as that. And we just see anger, and it gets more angry, and then you blow a gasket. Isn't it? It's the same. It's actually the same terminology as what happens when an engine overheats. It blows a gasket. When a body gets angered and overheat, it blows a gasket. So why I'm saying this is all of our emotions give us information and direction. When you start finding love, guess what? You drive to that, wherever that's coming from, that's where you go. And when you find fear, what do? You drive away from that, wherever that is from. So the feelings of fear and love determine where you're going to move. And the other kinds of feelings determine, well, how, in moving that way, how are you operating? And if we become aware of this, then we say, look, I'm not letting my emotions run me. I'm running my car using the emotions as a gauge, and I can then control the emotions. Otherwise, you're the person who never got driver training, got behind the car, you know, the wheel, started driving, and say, what are those lights and things on the dash? What is that stuff? That's the way we drive our vehicles today. Cells have jobs, cells have health care, cells have an economy, cells have politics, which is how they communicate with the central voice, the brain, with those emotions. And the fact is, if we would look at how cells do this and apply that same awareness to our world, then we would be able to live in harmony the way cells can live in harmony. That we would be able to have a world population share the wealth, the health, the protection that wouldn't even be needed that much when we all get together and realize we're all one body in the first place. And when we start doing this, the energy would come back into the system. And the mechanism of how to do it is, like I said, ATP is the equivalent of coins. You want to see why our economy failed? And the answer is, compare it to how a body handles an economy. Where's the energy going? Who's spending it? Who gets it? How do you earn it? And when you understand, like, oh, my God, what a beautiful system. Every cell gets paid. Not everybody gets the same pay. You know, neurons not only get paid more, but they even have an entourage. So, you know, they've got butlers and things like that because of their work level is real high compared to a skin cell, which, you know, hey, it's got all the energy it needs to get what? Food and you know, all the things it needs come to its door and then basically say, wow, we're the rich cells. And the cells that earn more have more, but there's a cap. You can only make so much money. It goes beyond which is like, that's too much money. And it says, what's this? It says that when you cap it, when you anything you make above a certain amount goes into the community. And the community uses that to keep the community going. So, like, if you break your leg, your liver cells say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to contribute any energy to that. You know, how do I care about the leg? And, of course, the simple reality is, yeah, if the leg is broken, the liver is going to essentially die if you can't get some food and handle yourself anyway. So the idea is, when you take the wealth, provide for everybody's basic requirements and allow people to go into to be called rich. Beyond that, the wealth goes into the community, and then the community uses that to maintain and build and keep that community running in proper high gear so that it's a community expenditure. And the wealthy cells still have all the money they need to get whatever they need, and everybody wins. We have a world today just the opposite. How much can I have, and I don't care how much you have. So Bill Gates can have $60 billion, and 90% of the rest of the world lives on, what, less than $10 a day. So it's like, that's not right.
Okay, in the world of cells, let's say that there's some progressives and there's some conservatives. They are fighting each other. Is this healthy?
Well, here's what actually, and I'm glad you brought that up, because here's what the evolution brings about. We have lived in a civilization of polarities. Everything has got polar opposites, you know, rich and poor, black or white, whatever, you know, conservative, liberal. And we look at all these polarities, and individuals that hold a polar view say, my side's right and your side's wrong. The new world of quantum physics and the new world of science says there are no two sides. They're all part of the same thing. And until you understand that, you will try to have one polar force against another polar force, when in truth, both visions can come together at the midline and recognize you need to have conservative aspects to, you know, assure your survival stuff, and you also need to have some liberal aspects to ensure your evolution as well. And so that basically it's being, you know, a liberal and a conservative at the same time. When you understand if we're all working together on this, the whole notion of polar sides must disappear and come together. We have religion versus science, and that's like that's been a polar thing for the last couple of hundred, well, 1,000 years, actually. And the significance about that is you cannot have a world that's just spiritual, and you cannot have a world that's just scientific, because as quantum mechanics says, that invisible stuff that we call spirit is actually there and does actually influence the physical mechanical world, but it also, the mechanical world influences the spiritual world. So guess what? There are no two opposite sides. They're both connected to each other. The world of science influences the world of spirituality, and now the world of spirituality is influencing the world of science, and they're coming to the midpoint. And our polar differences are what are actually generating the heat and the fire that is self-destructive.
So we will correct this imbalance by how?
With a new science, because it provides a vision of the world that the polar views have been fighting over, and the old polar, the polar views that worldview turns out not to be scientifically correct. So if I say, wait, get this idea, and I'll give you an example of an idea that's totally incorrect, because we didn't talk about the last two myths, and one of them says, according to science, we got here by random mutations, which means what? It means that there was no purpose for human evolution. We just got here by accident. The new science says, no, we didn't get here by random mutation. We got here through adaptive mutations. So, and what's the difference? Random mutations, just accidents. Adaptive mutations means each organism evolved to adapt to an environment in an effort to bring harmony to the environment. That humans didn't get here by accident. We got here as a part of nature's assembly to provide balance and harmony to the environment. That's the basis of the Native Americans, to tend the garden. That is exactly why we are here. And then you say, if that's why we're here, then what are we doing? It's like, we have trampled the garden. And the whole idea is, no, nature brought us here to bring harmony to the garden. So, uh-oh, we better change every way. And all of a sudden, we change that. And then we have a belief that we're here in a struggle for survival, that Darwinian belief that competition drives evolution. It turns out, oh, my God, that's a myth, because the new science says, no, evolution is driven by total cooperation.
Well, that's very interesting, considering right now that we're in this controversial issue surrounding healthcare and the need, we are told, for competition between the public option and the regular insurance companies. So is this a myth?
Total myth. That is the most destructive thing in the world, because what have the healthcare start with original healthcare. Who's involved? The doctor. Wherever he is out in the country 1,000 years ago, the doctor was involved with healthcare. What was the mission of the doctor? Compassionate healing to bring and maintain health of the community. And I say, what about today's world? What's healthcare? And I said, healthcare is a corporation that employs doctors. So what's the mission of the doctor? To heal people. Yeah, but the employer of doctors is called the corporation. What's the mission of the corporation? To make money. And then I say, 1,000 years ago, healing was a compassionate art. Today, healing is a corporate interest, and a corporate interest to make money. I say, well, who do you make your money from? And this is the crime and sin. They make their money from sick people who needed the compassion, and they charge them for the compassion. And it's like, what? Excuse me. The whole thing is corrupt. It's got to crash, and it's got to get out of the way. And the pharmaceutical industry, which is the money organization that has been pushing this, has to crash and get out of the way, because the pharmaceutical industry is one of the most destructive health influences in the world today. The pharmaceutical industry kills easily more than 300,000 people a year that take their normal prescription drugs. The pharmaceutical industry is the scourge of today's illegal drug market, because most of the illegal drugs that young people are using are pharmaceutical drugs. And the issue is, this is a scourge, and it's an abomination, and I'm really, you can see, I'm passionate about that.
As well you should.
It's because as a biologist, I realize healing is an internal job, and it involves you as a spirit and a consciousness manifesting control of your life. And we have been programmed that we are victims. And if we are programmed to be victims of our genes, when you are programmed to be a victim, what do you need? A rescuer. And guess what? Who inserted themselves between our health and ourselves is the pharmaceutical industry, saying, I am your rescuer, when in fact, they are the kiss of death.
So bottom line, Bruce, health insurance will make us sick and prevent us from taking full responsibility for our own health. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And seeing the education is what's so critical, because the first thing the public needs to know is, you know, public, you control your genes and your health. And it's like, what? To them, that would be like, what? The reality is, why? Because they still get articles in the newspaper, gene controls this and a gene controls that. And I love the joke, because they say a gene controls things. And it turns out that statement is the falsest statement I can imagine right now. Why? Because you gave genes a power of self-actualization. You gave genes the power that people say a gene turned on and a gene turned off. And biochemically, absolutely, totally false, incorrect. Why? Genes are blueprints. The blueprint doesn't have an on or off. I mean, go to the architect's office and she's working on a blueprint. You ask her, is the blueprint you're working on or off? And she'll look at you like, what are you talking about? And I say, you know what, Gene's a blueprint. There is no on and off. What's important about a blueprint? The blueprint is information for the contractor. And I say, the genes are the blueprints, and who's the contractor? The mind is the contractor. The mind can read the blueprints and actually change the blueprints. You can take each gene in your body, and through the perceptions of your mind, you can modify each gene in your body to create 30,000 different variations from the same gene. And all of a sudden, it's like, the genes aren't fixed. You can make 30,000 variations of each one. And all of a sudden, it's like, yep, your life is plastic, and it's shaped by your mind, the contractor.
So, in fact, we need the economy to go bust. We need to start from scratch. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and that's what people have to know, because of the reason is this. The way the bankers run the economy, we have all been indentured for the rest of our lives and our children's lives. And who are the bankers? Private few individuals that own the stocks and shares. And they own the rest of us. And can you ever get out of this? And the fact is, if you understand the nature of how it works, no. You're born into this debt, you'll never get out of this debt. And so we have to get rid of the bankers. And then you say, well, what will we do without money? The fact is, what did people do before they had money? They had bartered, they traded. They had a currency that was equal to a value. You know, when I talk about the cells get paid by this chemical called ATP, here's an interesting fact. If I go back a billion years ago and say, and this organism, let's say an amoeba, and I say for the amoeba to carry out this process, it takes 35 ATP molecules. And that was a billion years ago. And I come back today and I say, here's an amoeba, and I say, how much does it cost for you to do this process? And the answer is 35 ATP molecules. What was the point? Currency doesn't change value. The currency has a real meaning, and the realness of it is real. But in our world today, the currency value changes every minute. You go online, you can watch the value of the money going up and down. It's like, what kind of money goes up and down in value when ATP molecules have the same value for billion years? And the reality is, we need to make a currency like ATP that has a value to it that stays the same. And then everybody knows where we are, and nobody manipulates that. And therefore, we live in a real currency. The United States, before the revolution, and what precipitated the revolution, was the United States had created a new currency called colonial scrip. And that was value equal to the money. If it says this is equal for one chicken, it's always worth one chicken. And never later down the line, today that's only worth half a chicken. No, it's always worth one chicken. So value was the same. How did they do this? Because they stopped being involved with the currency provided from the Bank of England, which is a private bank. And that forced the Bank of England to force the king to start the revolution, because we disconnected from the currency system. When we did, we were highly successful. But then what happened after the revolution at some point, our currency system was taken over by the banks again, and now we have what is called the Federal Reserve Bank. And, of course, a lot of people think that's part of the government. It's like, no, it's a private bank, just like the Bank of England's a private bank. So private people control the currency. And it's like, but when they make it go up and down, they make us like marionettes. They pull on our strings. And the fact is, how do you can't trust anything anymore. And that's why, because the money is not a tangible, real thing. It's anything they make it, they can print more today or tomorrow. And so, yes, the economy will fail because the money is not real, and it's a way of a few people controlling the entire population. And so the failure of money is important. And what will happen when it fails? Well, okay, it's going to fail. And like I said, people are going to be scared. And I can say, guess what? There are ways out of this. And the ways out are start to get back into the original way that we were all protected, and that was we all had a thing called community. In our world today, communities have been fractured, even to the extent that a family is no longer a community. And you say, what's been fractured? And I say, why? And the answer is, when you break up a community, the people lose their power. And you want to get your power back? Well, the evolution is to return us right now back to the community, and the ultimate community is the one community called humanity.
It's really amazing to me, and it's a new concept to think that you have to have both opposing forces, like the liberals and the conservatives, in order to be healthy.
Yes, you have to have both. And yet here, so but why is it relevant? Because you can talk about two aspects of the crisis. And the one is the health care we receive, and the other is the amount of money we spend for health care. And what I'm going to tell you right now, based on the new science and the recognition of a simple fact, which is scary into itself, is that the leading cause of death in the United States by statistics is the healthcare profession itself. So, you know, it's like, my God, they're the leading cause of death. Yeah, because they have a misunderstanding of science, and when they're practicing from that misunderstanding, they're creating the crisis. So, yeah, the healthcare industry must fail itself. And secondarily, the money is going to fail. So the whole argument of supporting a healthcare system with this money is both of them have to fail. So it makes no difference to me which one, how they resolve it. It's not, whatever way they resolve it, it won't work because they're not trying to change the healthcare and they don't want to change the money. So both of them are going to fail anyway. It's a good thing because when we start to return health back to the patient, because we've made them victims. And as I said, if I program you to be a victim, then I program you to need my services as a rescuer. And that means you're indentured for your health. And in fact, we are masters of our health.
Wow, that's really powerful to realize that everything in our current life is to make people become victims. It's really all about power.
When you were a child, almost, you know, unless you grew up in a special family, every child in the first 5 or 6 years of his life, that's where programming occurs. Then the phrase is, oh, Billy's sick, we have to take him to the doctor. When you hear that in the first 6 years of your life as programming, and you hear it more than once, and other members of your family go and get the same consequences, what does a child learn as a habit? The answer is this: if I am sick, I don't heal myself, I go to the doctor. And why that's relevant is because you've taken the power away from the child. And it's interesting because we are innately able to heal ourselves. Here's a joke. We're innately able to heal ourselves, but we put a program in by habit in that first 6 years that says, if I am sick, I go to the doctor. What's interesting is nobody ever said what the doctor had to do. So basically, what was the permission? The permission is I was able to heal myself. Then I put a program in that says, before I heal myself, I go to the doctor. That means all I have to do is just go to the doctor, and I'll start getting well. And the answer is, absolutely. That's what most people report. On the way to the doctor or in the doctor's office, all of a sudden, I feel a lot better. And the fact was, yeah, you were able to do that before, but you put a program in the subconscious, the habit mind, that says, before I heal myself, I go to the doctor. And that's the joke. All you had to do was go to the doctor. You didn't have to do anything. You just got better already.
So I understand that things must fall down for us to start again. But if we believe that we're going to be perfectly fine and it's really not going to be that big of an ordeal, then in fact, it's not going to be because of our belief system. Is that correct?
There'll be a harmony that will all bring us together. The concept of a fear that there, you know, that somebody's going to get me, or there won't be enough for me, or somebody won't take care of me, all the fears that in some way influence our survival will almost essentially disappear. And if you could experience something like that, which I myself did, it is the most enlightening, and I mean lightning in the sense of weight. Once I realized this, it was like when the fears were gone, life was like, oh my God, I didn't realize there was that much weight on me all the time. It's an unconscious weight. We're programmed with that through our life experiences, our mortality. We know we're going to die. Well, the question is, when are we going to die? Well, we don't want to die forever. So anything that, you know, we unconsciously, as we go through the world, our unconscious mind, one of the primary things it does is to keep on constant surveillance for that threat that will cause your life to be compromised. So that most of the time, the subconscious mind is looking around for where's the next thing coming from. And the fact is, what if you didn't have to put all your energy into doing that unconsciously? Well, that gives the unconscious then energy to do all the other kinds of things you would like to do with your life. And when you feel the fear go away, there's a lightness of being that is extremely hard to describe, but it's like, oh my God, it's so much easier to be here now. And the population is going to come to that because they're going to learn that they're not just these physical bodies. There's also an entangled energy field that goes on and on and on, and that the concept of reincarnation, and that we can control our health, and all these things that we've been fearing that we were out of control, when we stop fearing them, there'll be so much extra energy that we put into that protection that we don't need to do.
So are you suggesting that by the year 2012 or whatever's going on right now, that we're going to be forced to be this new spiritual species?
Absolutely, because that's where the quantum physics will start to recognize that with the new biology, that we are, everything that's physical is also created an energy field. And why that's important is because if the physical part disappears, that doesn't necessarily influence that the energy field goes away. The energy field is still there. Very simply, I tell people, like, cells are like, and the body collective as cells, is like a television set. Each one of us has on the surfaces of our cells these antennas, like little television antennas, that receive a station. Each one of us receives a different station, but the broadcast is not inside the body, it's from the outside. And if the broadcast is on the outside, then, like I said, it's like a television. I said, my life is this television set. And you'd say, television picture tube breaks. You say, television's dead. And I go, yeah, television's dead. It doesn't work anymore. But then I say, when the television picture tube blew out, did the broadcast stop? The answer is, no. Well, how would you know? Get a new TV, plug it in, turn it on, and tune it to the right station. Boom, it's back on air. Well, we are the equivalent of a broadcast because we're part of an energy field. The body disappears, television's dead, broadcast still there, get another television, another body at a future time, put the same set of antennas on it that draws your station in, boom, you're back on, but in a different body and a different reality. Cool,
that's
really cool.
Really cool. I love it. Bruce, we are actually over our time limit, but I don't want to stop. There's still something very important that you have put in your book that I think everybody wants to know about. You were talking about the founding fathers, but who were America's true founding mothers?
Well, the story really talks about the fact that the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were actually predicated on a United States that existed before the Europeans got here. The United States that existed was the Indian nation. It's called the Iroquois Nation. It was essentially a collection of seven individual Indian tribes that decided instead of being individuals and fighting each other, it would be better they come together and form one giant united community. And that way, they didn't have to spend all their profits and energy and work on supporting protection and war because they all stopped fighting with each other. And they had a set of rules on how they ran our country. The fundamental rules of governance are the rules that the founding fathers used and put in the Constitution, except for one thing. And that was, and it was very difficult, I think, because the Europeans came, of course, with their own baggage and history, and they came to this Indian nation and copied the rules of this Iroquois nation as our foundation. But the Iroquois nation also had something called the Council of Grandmothers. And the Council of Grandmothers were the wise women, older women of the tribe. And what was important about them is that they were the ones that selected the chief. They were the ones that actually allowed for wars. And they controlled it. And if the chief of the tribe wasn't, you know, a collectively good chief, then the grandmothers could remove them. And so it was the wisdom of the grandmothers that shaped who ran the tribe and what they would do. And it was just a wonderful experience because as a woman, yes, they were very much, concerned about protection, but they were also concerned about the growth of their own community, their family, and their children. So as leadership, the women said, yes, we want our chief to be very much a warrior, but we want our chief to be very much a father. And so they selected chiefs that had those traits. In today's world, we more or less select warriors because the wisdom of maintaining the family and the community and the health and the growth and the environment is more of a feminine approach to life. And a masculine approach is more of a protection and a support posture. And since we have been in a patriarchal world since the Europeans got here, we have lost that wisdom. And so the necessity of our future is, remember, the opposite polarities must come together. Our chief must not only be strong in conviction of being a warrior, but our chief must be a father who can heal and hold a family together. And so we bring these opposite traits back together again so that the female traits and the male traits are co-expressed. And when they become co-expressed, that's when harmony will, you know, again form, because if we're led by combatants in a world believed, you know, like I said, a Darwinian world that's based on the survival of the fittest and struggle, well, you know, we're always looking out for our survival in the regard to protection and competition. But a new world that says, wait, that's half of life. The other half of life is growth and maintenance and harmony. And when those two come back together, which is coming at this time, male and female attributes coming back together, then we are poised for an evolutionary leap out of this combative world into a more harmonious garden.
Wow, that's what we need, a grandmother's council for the entire world. That's it. What a great, great idea.
So let's put it right back into the situation the Indians have. Let the women vote for the president only. And it would return it almost immediately to a survival-oriented country. But then, of course, we have to watch out for the other countries who are also voting for their warriors.
Well, let's start a campaign for Dr. Bruce Lipton to be president of the United States. Boy, women would vote for him.
Well, that would be fun, but I wish I would sit on a porch and watch the sunsets while the world gets peaceful and harmonious and the garden grows again so I could see that peace. That would be wonderful. Well, it's just a little nudge, you know, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, there's a better way coming right up. And the big message is there is a better way coming up, and that what you see right now is actually a pathway to that better way. So when you see the destruction, it's sort of like, you know, in a birth process, there's a bit of destruction of the tissue in the process of the birthing itself. And so we have to go through a breaking of this structure to birth the new structure. And when you see it that way, then when you look at it, it's like, oh, cool, because as this thing goes, as soon as it goes down, we can begin a new structure. But until it goes down, it's holding us back. And so my last thing to just say is that unfortunately, the media wants you to live in fear, because the more fear you're in, the less power you exert over your life and what goes on. And what we need to do is stop buying the fear and recognize the reality of what each of us is, and that each of us is a creator. And when we become coherent and all of us start to express the same kind of beliefs of harmony and love, the world will instantly manifest that way. And that's our spontaneous evolution.
Thanks, Bruce. This is a major education for us tonight. Thank you so much. What would we do without you?
I appreciate that, but you know what's more fun? It's really the science. So let's appreciate the science, because that's our freedom and our liberation, and I so love it because I've tasted it for a while and wrote the biology of belief on how how we run it so you can get our powers back. And for me, it's an exciting experience because I'm a resolution of my own experiment, and I am living amidst all this turmoil. And yet I see it as like an exciting adventure, and I see the garden that will be unfolding. And I wish all of us could do that, because it would be so much easier to make this transition without feeding it with the fire of fear.
And the best way to get rid of the fear is to go out and buy Bruce's book, Spontaneous Evolution. And you can go to his website, brucelipton.com. And we are out of time, so I want to thank Bruce again and thank all the wonderful listeners. Remember, each one of us is making a huge difference in shifting the consciousness of the world. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us on Law of Attraction Talk Radio with Jules. For more information, go to Law of Attraction Radio Network at lawofattracttalkradio.com or lawofattractiontools.com.